Thank you very much for being here, and thank you to our speaker. So our speaker today is Howard Wiseman, and he will talk about Can a Qubit Be Your Friend? And whenever you want, you can start.
All right, thank you, Flaminia. So thank you to the organizers of the seminar series at PI for inviting me. So Can a Qubit Be Your Friend? The subtitle, Why Experimental Metaphysics Needs a Quantum Computer. I'm Howard Wiseman. I'm at Griffith University, which is in Southeast Queensland here in Australia. And this work is supported by FQXI and by the Australian-wide Centre for Quantum Computation and Communication Technology. So obviously this is, this is work, joint work with many people that I'll be reporting on. So the first part of the talk, I'll be talking about this paper, which came out just last year, A Strong No-Go Theorem on the Wigner's-Friend Paradox, which gives you some idea what the talk's about if you haven't read the abstract and just going by the title. But then in the second half of the talk, I'm going to get on to some unpublished work, work in preparation even. I should say more about the authors. So most of the authors here are from the Center for Quantum Dynamics at Griffith University. It's a mixture of experimentalists and theorists. But I should also point out Yong Cheng Liang at National Cheng Kung University in Taiwan. Okay, this other work in preparation with Eric Cavalcanti, who is one of the authors on this paper as well, and with Eleanor Riefel. And as I said, this is more a bit more speculative and is just in preparation. Okay, so this is the outline of the talk. I'll begin with introduction. Then go on to the new theorem and the new experiment, which is the topic of that Nature Physics paper. And then in the third part, I'll go on to the, the in preparation work and conclude. Okay, so to begin, so the motivation for this work. So being a member of the Center for Quantum Computation and Communication Technology, we're always after new customers for a quantum computer. And here, you know, this work is really focused on the very large customer base of philosophers wanting to advance experimental metaphysics. Obviously not really, it is true that I think that this work does, as we'll see in the second part of the talk, does combine quantum computing and philosophy or metaphysics. Okay, so what is metaphysics? Just in case there are people here who don't know, here's one definition. It's the branch of philosophy that deals with the first principles of things, such as being, knowing, identity, time, and space. So, yeah, I'll just leave that the standard it is. So metaphysics has a bit of a bad name in science, or it has done for centuries, but with putting experimental in front of it, it really becomes again undeniably part of science. So where did this phrase experimental metaphysics come from, and what does it mean? Well, it comes from this book from 1987 in a chapter by philosopher Abner Shimony, where yes, he coined this phrase, and basically the idea being that we can do experiments that probe this in concepts in metaphysics, these very basic concepts in philosophy. And so this is a phrase, I think, experimental physics, that's starting to get more currency. So this was a conference organized not long ago in 2017, 30 years after this book. So obviously 1987 was the time of this book. And indeed, one of the speakers in this the conference was my colleague Eric Cavalcanti, although not on the work that I'll be talking about here. Okay, so that is the topic which this talk bit. But you can see from the title of this book, Philosophical Consequences of Quantum Theory, Reflections on Bell's Theorem, we see that Bell's Theorem is really the beginning of this field of experimental metaphysics. And so it makes sense that I'm going to spend some time talking about Bell's Theorem in a way that will connect most easily to what I'm going to go on to talk about. All right, so what is Bell's Theorem? Well, for the purpose of this talk, a quite clear statement of that is found in Bell's original 1964 paper. Okay, so here's a quote from the paper. What is Bell's Theorem? It is that the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics are incompatible with separable predetermination. Okay, what does he mean by that? Well, thankfully, he goes on. That is, well, in any theory in which parameters determine the results of individual measurements, so that's the predetermination, it must be not separable. There must be a mechanism whereby the setting of one measurement device can influence the reading of another instrument, however remote. Okay. So you see I've used two different colors here. So the brown here about the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics, I'm using that to emphasize that he is not assuming quantum mechanics to be correct in this paper. It's saying quantum mechanics makes certain predictions, okay? If we go into the lab and see these predictions pan out, then that is incompatible with these basic philosophical assumptions. So Bell's theorem is not, in essence, a theorem about quantum mechanics. It's a theorem about certain things that we can see in the laboratory, which happen to be predicted by quantum mechanics, which is, of course, very relevant because it's our best theory. So we expect that if quantum mechanics makes statistical predictions, then they will actually be borne out in the laboratory. Okay, so in 1964, this was not yet the case. These predictions had not been tested, had not been seen in the laboratory, but of course, it was not long before experiments were done, and there have been many, many experiments over the years. And I'm not going to go into the details, but I think most people agree that in 2015, experiments, since then, we can just say that experiments have been done with no caveats about loopholes. We more or less agree that Bell experiments, okay, so this is just facts about what we observe in the laboratory, rule out the conjunction of some metaphysical assumptions. So I'm going to state these here more formally than Bell did, and they're not exactly the same. There are many ways of formulating Bell's theorem. This is the way that is most useful for what I want to go on to do in this talk. Okay. I should say for people who came in late that I'm happy to take questions along the way, but if I think that questions better deferred to the end, then I'll just do that. Okay. So these are the assumptions. So the first one is an assumption that is just Bell certainly didn't mention in 1964 and almost nobody mentions. It's just an implicit assumption that when you have these parties in laboratories, distant laboratories making the measurements, that when they make an observation, then that result of that observation really exists in an absolute sense. So I'm calling it here absoluteness of observation. An observation is a real single event and not relative to anything or anyone. Okay, just a background assumption, you might say. The second one, I'll use the same term that Bell used in 1964, predetermination of observable events. Now, it's surprisingly not elegant to formulate this in a rigorous way. So I don't think I'm even going to read through what I've written here. You can see by the color that it's not very nice. But the reason I'm not going to go through it in detail is because this is the assumption that we're going to get rid of as we go down later in the talk. Okay, so I think everyone has an intuitive idea about what this means, and that will do for the moment. Okay, and then the third assumption, again, is not what I'm going to use. I'm not going to use any of the terms that Bell used in 1964 or his later papers. I'm going to use this other notion here, which actually does is quite elegantly expressed and does all the work that we need to be able to complete Bell's derivation, arrive with Bell's Bell inequalities, etc. Okay, and that is this assumption of local action, and that says that any free choice, which I'll call X, for example, made in a manner appropriate for a randomized experiment, is for the purpose of that experiment correlated only with events in its future light cone. Okay, so I think that's a fairly natural assumption I want to make for the experts. This assumption is not the same as local causality, nor is it the same as locality. And the job it's doing here is that it will also rule out superdeterminism. Okay, so it's doing quite a lot of work, but it's actually, I think, a very natural assumption to make. That'll do. All right. So how does that work? So this is a Bell scenario, which would be familiar to many people, hopefully almost everyone. We have two labs. So time is going vertically. So here's Alice's lab, here's Bob's lab. Alice makes some setting choices X and gets some outcome A, Bob Y and B. And we might imagine for predetermination some space-like hypersurf, which is prior to all this experimental goings on. And on that space-like hypersurface, there may be variables. Okay. So the first assumption, absolute observed events, I essentially have just used to, you know, when I write down these events, they are just events in space-time. Okay, I don't need to say anything more about that. They all exist. That's essentially all that's happening. Okay, so then what we get with predetermination, that says that there are these lambdas which exist such that the probability of outcome A given setting X, setting Y, and these hidden variables is determined. I can't remember what I started that sentence with. If it's with probability, then it's that the probabilities are either zero or one, right? Which means the outcomes either happen, any given outcome either happens or doesn't happen. And that's determined. And the same thing with Bob's on this side. Local action, on the other hand, says that the probability of A, given all those things that it might depend on, in fact, only depends on things in this past light cone. So that would be the setting choice X, but not the setting choice Y. And likewise for B. And as I say, it also does the work of saying that the probability for these lambdas is independent of X and Y. So conditioning on X and Y doesn't change that. So whether you think of that as a no superdeterminism condition or a no retrocausality condition, it's mathematically identical, and it's all we need for the result. Okay, so the point is that I just take these simple equations. I see what constraints they imply on this joint probability distribution. And again, absoluteness of observed events just means that there exists a joint probability distribution like this. Okay. So these assumptions imply constraints. And the important point is that experiments violate those constraints. Okay, so that's really what experimental metaphysics is all about. We just make these very broad assumptions, metaphysical assumptions, put them in conjunction, come up with implications, and then we can go into the laboratory and see that those are violated. Okay, hopefully that's just revision for people, but in perhaps a slightly different way from what you're used to seeing. Okay, so the other big ingredient in this new work is some other work from the 1960s by Wigner. As you've seen, Wigner's friend has come up in somewhere, I'm sure it came up in one of my slides. So this, yeah, is not really a theorem, okay? So I've called it Wigner's musings, because he certainly didn't prove a theorem in the way that Bell did. But it's been a quite influential paper. So it's a book chapter called Remarks on the Mind-Body Question. And I think it's worth just reading what Wigner wrote at that time. Obviously, I've chosen a very specific part, which is going to be relevant here. So he says, it's natural to ask about, this is after he's talked about how measurements work in quantum theory. It is natural to ask about the situation if one does not make an observation oneself, but let someone else carry it out. What is the wave function if my friend looked at the quantum object? So this is the first time that Binger's friend appears in the literature. The answer is that one could only attribute a wave function to the joint system of friend plus object. And he writes out an entangled wave function for the friend plus object and says this follows from the linearity of Schrodinger's equation. And this appears absurd because it implies that the friend was in a state of suspended animation, in other words, in the superposition state, before he answered my question about what he saw. Then Wigner's conclusion is it follows that Schrodinger's equation cannot be linear if it is accepted that my friend has the same types of impressions and sensations as I. Okay, so as I said, it's not a theorem here, it's just an argument. It's not, he's just sort of saying, well, let's assume that quantum mechanics applies to friend, this appears absurd. But I think what we're basically going to do is to put Wigner's musings together with Bell's experiment to actually come up with something rigorous that we can say about Wigner's friend, okay, in an experimental metaphysics sense. And that's what this section two is. All right, so it's we are not the first people to do this, and we're very much building on work by Czeslaw Bruckner. So a couple of years ago, he wrote this article here, which was incorporating Wigner's friends into a Bell experiment. And indeed, we're following his intuition that what we want to do is to get rid of Bell's assumption of predetermination by replacing the hidden variables in that formulation by observations by the friends. Okay. Now, a critical thing which is going on here is that completely contrary to the way Wigner talked about his friends, for Wigner, he only imagined, you know, the friend makes an observation and then I ask the friend what he saw. And, you know, the conflict seems to come from just what the quantum mechanical description of that is. In much of the subsequent literature on Wigner's friend, people have, you know, thought about, because technology has moved on a lot since 1961, thought about the possibility of actually doing quantum manipulations on the state of the friend. So one of the assumptions that Bruckner makes is essentially that quantum mechanics is universal, and so that that Wigner is in fact in its superposition, and that that superposition indeed can be manipulated from the outside by, you know, Wigner, by the person who for whom the friend is a friend. Okay, sometimes called a super observer, as we'll see. Okay, so that was, as I said, so that was Bruckner's idea. So why am I not telling you about Bruckner's theorem? Well, the problem is that the way Bruckner formalized his theorem, or formalized his intuition, if you like, he ended up making assumptions that were just as strong as Bell had already made. So essentially, so I think he had the right intuition, but he didn't actually end up proving anything stronger than we already had from Bell's theorems, because his assumptions end up being the same. But luckily, what we have done is found a new theorem by making much weaker formalizations of the assumptions behind Bruckner's idea. And so we end up with something which is actually much stronger than Bell's theorem, although, yeah. I shouldn't say that. I mean, it's different in that it implies a different experiment, as we'll see. So swings and roundabouts. Okay, I'll just call this the Griffith theorem for the moment. That what we actually proved, and so that's what's in this paper here. So what are the assumptions that go into this theorem? So this is not. If you look at this paper, you won't see the formulation looking exactly like this, and I don't want to explain why it ended up this way, but this is essentially the way I would explain the theorem, is that the conjunction of these three assumptions is a contradiction. So first assumption, the same one that I talked about for Bell's theorem, Absolutes of observations. An observation is a real single event and not relative to anything or anyone. And so some of you might know, yes, we actually had this earlier paper by Eric and myself. We had this assumption by the name of macro reality. But yeah, so it's some people have already talked about it in the context of Bell's theorem, and here it is appearing again. Okay, local action, exactly as before. Okay, any free choice is correlated only with events in its future light cone, but you see that predetermination has gone. Okay, and in its place is this assumption, which I'm calling cheekily here superpowers, and that's because, as I said, the person at the highest level, often known as a super observer, the person playing the Vigna role, the assumption here is that super observer can perform arbitrary quantum operations on an observer, the friend, and the friend's environment. Now, again, I'm using this brick color here to emphasize that this is not a metaphysical assumption. Okay? We are not making the assumption that quantum mechanics is universally valid. We are just saying we're making it like quantum mechanics, at least as most people interpret it, has a prediction that this is possible. But this is a prediction that can be tested in the laboratory. So we're not assuming the universal validity of quantum theory. We're just assuming that for a friend, and we'll get on to what a friend is, can have arbitrary quantum operations done on it to some, you know, the required degree of accuracy. That's all that this means. Okay, so what can we do with this? So how does it work? So we begin with as I said, it's Bell plus Vigna. So we're going to have two friends and two Vignas, so to speak. But we'll use the usual sort of quantum information names for these parties. So we begin with our two friends in two boxes, so Charlie and Debbie, sharing an entangled particle. And they simply make measurements on those entangled particles and get results, Charlie and Debbie. Now I'm going to concentrate on half of this scenario now, and the other half, the same thing is happening. Okay, so for Charlie, now Charlie is the friend of Alice, and Alice, unlike Charlie and Debbie, actually makes measurement choices. So if Alice decides to measure or decides that use setting one, what that means is that Alice just opens the box and asks Charlie what he saw. And whatever Charlie says, Alice takes that to be the result of that run of the experiment. On the other hand, if Alice chooses some other setting, so this is an either or situation, if Alice chooses X not equal to one, then she does something rather different. Essentially, she presses a time reverse button on some machine that's outside the box. And what that does is reverse time inside the box. And I should say, it's not so much that it reverses time, it reverses whatever unitary operation has happened for the last couple of seconds inside the box. Okay, so it returns the box to whatever quantum state it had before, a few seconds ago, which is this situation that Charlie in it and a quantum particle waiting to be measured. Okay, so the superpowers assumption is that Alice can do this, and then she simply throws Charlie away and makes a measurement on the particle that was in the box. So she can make, depending on which settings, she could measure in a different property of that particle and write down the answer that she gets. Okay, so then, as I said, on the other side, the same thing is happening with Debbie and Bob. So now this is this situation. So it's not important that this is a space-like hypersurface, but, and you know, these are roughly where the things are sitting. So Alice's choice, the outcome, et cetera, et cetera. But instead of considering hidden variables, what we have is the outcome that Charlie got from his measurement and the outcome which Debbie got from her measurement. So the absoluteness of observed events assumption is just that all of these outcomes really exist, okay, in space-time. So there exists a joint probability distribution over A, B, C, D. And Moreover, right, so then if we look at what Alice and Bob can possibly see, they're just going to be marginal. The probability distribution for that will be marginal over something over Charlie and Debbie. And moreover, we know that if Alice measures in with setting one, so this is just shorthand for that, then that's her result is equal to C, and likewise Bob and Debbie, B1 equals to D. Local action performs in the same way as we've seen before, except with C and D, as I said, playing the roles of the hidden variables. So those equations are the same as we got before. Okay, so we in the paper, we coined the phrase local friendliness for the conjunction of these two metaphysical assumptions. So these are all metaphysical. Yeah, this is a metaphysical concept. And the point is that we can, from this assumption, we can derive inequalities, or we can derive constraints, and those constraints lead to inequalities. And the important point for the theorem is that those inequalities can be violated if the appropriate superpowers exist. So in other words, I mean, to stress again, we're not assuming that quantum mechanics is universal. All that we require is, to some reasonable experimental accuracy, the Alice and Bob can do this undoing operation so that the probability that for their results A, B given X, Y, when they undo Charlie and Debbie measurements is approximately the same as if Charlie and Debbie had just never been there in the first place and Alice and Bob had directly measured the quantum particles. Okay, so that's all we require, and we can get violation of what we call local friendliness inequalities. And so we have this new theorem of experimental metaphysics that says if we can do this, then in the lab, then yeah, we know that local friendliness must be false. Okay, and then we did an experiment. So there are a lot of details, technical and experimental details behind that. What we showed, why some of it's interesting. Because of time constraints, I'm going to skip over this, but if anybody wants to ask about the sort of things that appear on this slide, I'm leaving it up for a second or two for people to decide, then they can ask at the end and I can come back. Okay, but what I wanted to do is actually skip over this and just have a quick look at the experimental setup. Okay, so this is a quantum optics experiment. So it was done with entangled photons. This is an entangled photon source down the bottom. And these photons are entangled in their polarization. This is Alice's lab over here, and this is Bob's lab over here. So where is Charlie, you ask? Okay, so this is the tricky bit. Charlie in this experiment is just a qubit. And in fact, Charlie is just the qubit, which is a binary path degree of freedom of the photon. Okay, so the photon begins with just the polarization degree of freedom. But what we do here is to create correlations, indeed entanglement, between the polarization of this photon and where it is in space. Okay, so there are two possible paths that it can have. And we have to think of that qubit, that path qubit, as Charlie. Right? So at this point, this process here, this polarization sensitive beam splitter or path, no, not a beam splitter, it's a displacer, path displacer or something, is essentially the measurement that Charlie does. It creates a perfect correlation or near perfect correlation between the photon's polarization, which is the initial qubit, and the position of that photon, which is Charlie. Okay. Now, then if Alice wants to ask Charlie what he saw, then Alice just deflects Charlie, so to speak, into a couple of detectors and just sees where the photon is. Is it in this arm or in that arm? And then that's basically like asking Charlie what he saw. As I said, if Alice wants to do some other experiment on the polarization of the photon, then she has to reverse Charlie's measurement. And that's performed by just putting in some optical elements here, which remove this. So at this point here, the photon is back in just a single position. Charlie is being essentially erased. or Charlie's memory has been erased, and there's we just have the polarization of the photon, which Alice can then measure in any basis she likes. And that's what's happening at the end here. And the same thing is happening on Bob's side with Bob's friend Debbie, who's also this single qubit. Okay, so what did the experiment show? Well, we showed violation of local friendliness inequalities by lots of standard deviations. Okay, not too surprising, like our experimental colleagues, Jeff Pride's lab, very good. Okay, but the question which I'm hoping is in all your minds, we haven't really got to the question yet. Okay, so just to emphasize, as I said, each friend here is just this single qubit, the photon path. It's a very small scale experiment, and that's how we are able to do it. Okay, so obviously we don't really have superpowers. I would say the experimentalists are very good, but they're not super powerful yet, but they're powerful enough to reverse the measurement of one qubit by another qubit. Right, so then the question is, as I have in my title, well, can a qubit be a friend? Okay, now this is a bit controversial. Some people actually, some other experimental groups, in fact, have published work where they answered this question in the positive, said, yes, a qubit is as good a friend as anybody else. That's not my point of view, and it's not what we said in the paper. In our paper, we say, no, this is obviously not a real Vigdis friend experiment, not a real local friendliness experiment. What we called it was a microscopic proof of principle version of a local friendliness experiment. Okay, so we think, well, certainly my perspective is that we have to be thinking about a real experiment. That's where I'm interested in going. Where do we go from here? What will actually make a friend a real friend? Okay, how do we get rid of the scare quotes around friend? Well, there are many different ways one could think about going forward. So one would be just to get larger and more complex quantum systems. I think that's certainly interesting, but it's not clear, you know, what the threshold would be for being large or sufficiently complex. There are many different criteria. I think that's definitely interesting to look at, but it's not clear to me when you're going to get to the point of saying, oh, okay, that's good enough. I just don't know if we'll ever get there. Many people would say, well, if you want to know what an observation is, what's a real observation, go back to Bohr. Well, actually, Bohr is very, very unclear, but Wheeler at least gave a what he thought Bohr meant, which was a Bohr that the measurement is an irreversible act of amplification. And that seems like a pretty good definition. But of course, that's not going to work for the experiment we want to do, because if the act of amplification is irreversible, if it really is irreversible, then we just can't do the experiment. Because the essence of the experiment is to be able to undo the measurement that has been made by the friends. Okay, so we want an act of observation which is plausible as an act of observation and yet can be reversed. How can we do that? Well, I think essentially we want to go back to Vigdis' original idea, like what he had in mind when he talked about the Vigdis friend scenario, was a being with the same types of impressions and sensations as I. Okay. And I think that's the best feasible option. But how can we imagine doing that? We can't, obviously I can't reverse myself, I can't reverse any of you. How would we possibly do that? The answer is we would have to build, I believe, an artificial intelligence realized on an enormously large fault-tolerant quantum computer. Okay? And so this is why experimental physics needs a quantum computer. Yes, good question from Lee.
Yes, remember your many classical world scenario?
Yes.
Yeah, so I would propose for a threshold, the number of worlds, suppose the number of worlds in your setup was finite, we call it n, and n was small enough. That would is that a threshold you could work with?
If it was small enough.
Yes. Presumably quantum mechanics is reproduced in a limit that n is large.
Yes. Gosh, I don't know. So that's presupposing that then quantum mechanics would be, that we would be seeing deviations from quantum mechanics. I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't, that's certainly not a direction I'd thought about using as a criterion. I have to maybe give that some more thought. I'm not going to agree immediately, at least let's put it that way.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, there's another question.
Hello. It's just a clarification question. I didn't understand why in this case with the qubit, you did not require superpowers, because as far as I understood, superpowers is just the ability of undoing the unitary. Right?
Yeah. Okay. So if you agree that this is a real friend, then I suppose we could say that, yes, we do have superpowers in the laboratory. When I called it superpowers, I was sort of presupposing not really an experiment like this, but rather an experiment where everybody would agree, or that's too much to hope for, but at least where a large section of physicists would agree that the things being experimented on really were friends. But in a technical sense that, yes, we were able to reverse the evolution here, then yes, we do actually in the laboratory have sufficient powers to do the experiment. And that's right. So we have done this proof of principle version in which, yes. So yes, we have sufficient powers, sufficient man to do this experiment. Does that answer the question?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So getting back to where, what I think is the direction we have to go is towards this, as I said, so this enormous fault-tolerant quantum computer to run some artificial intelligence algorithm and for that to be our friend. Okay. So that's then this what I want to go on to in this third section, going beyond the toy experiments, as we might call it. So how would this work then? So it turns out one of the results that we have in our paper is we don't actually need two friends to derive the inequalities under certain circumstances. We only need one friend. So let's simplify to that. We only need one enormous fault-tolerant quantum computer. Yay, the experiment is only half as difficult, not in the way that experimentalists talk about it. I think they use a log scale for difficulty. Here is Charlie, our friend, this enormous computer running some artificial intelligence algorithm, as I said, and having some private thoughts. Alice and Bob, we have to think of Charlie here as a friend. It's not as if we know Charlie's quantum state. Charlie is a party the same as Alice and Bob. Charlie is going to measure one of these entangled pairs of qubit. Bob is going to measure the other one. What does it mean for Charlie to measure this qubit? Well, it really means that qubit just gets incorporated into the matrix of Charlie's qubits. But in a way that, Charlie can make inferences about, if we were talking about the logical basis of the qubit, that, Charlie would then be able to reliably report if this qubit were in a definite up or down state, that Charlie would be able to reliably report that, etc. Okay, but Charlie just sees this qubit in some sense, thinks about the outcome that he saw, and mulls that over for however long we care to let it happen. It depends on what Alice chooses to do. So if Alice chooses setting one, again, she just asks Charlie through some interface what he saw. And Charlie can report, I saw spin up and that makes me feel good, or whatever he chooses to say. Okay, so that's the result that Alice writes down. On the other hand, again, the other situation, if Charlie chooses, Alice chooses one of the other settings, then what she does is hit a unitary reverse. And so this is where we assume that, right, so this is the fact that Charlie is this universal quantum computer comes into it, that we can perform logical reverse operations on the computer, which will just effectively take Charlie back to whatever the initial state was, okay, here, right? So the point is we don't have to know what Charlie's initial state was in order to reverse the unitary evolution, but we can just by doing reverse operations, telling the computer hardware, okay, now do everything in reverse, in a logical sense, take Charlie back to whatever this initial state was, and then throw Charlie away, and make Alice make some measurement directly on this qubit. Okay, and then once again, so I didn't go through the details, but one can derive these inequalities and they can be violated if we believe that we can do these sort of operations on a quantum computer, which I think is a lot more plausible, obviously, than thinking about doing it on a human. Right, so how's the time? Not too bad. Okay, so there are many issues with doing an experiment like this. Okay, what do we have to simulate to actually simulate an artificial intelligence? Is it necessary for an artificial intelligence to be embodied or to believe they're embodied or to feel like they're embodied in a three-dimensional environment? That's going to be enormously challenging. So let's consider a simpler option, which is maybe just simulating a mind, so to speak. So we assume that you can have intelligence even if everything is just even if we're not simulating the whole environment. That's possible, I think. So we'd still, you know, this is probably a way underestimate about like how many qubits one would need for this. And I'm talking about logical qubits, not physical qubits. So this is not going to happen anytime soon. Important to note that during the experiment, like while Charlie is here, you know, mulling over whatever he saw, he has to be completely isolated from the environment because we want to be able to perform this reversal. Okay, so Charlie is essentially going to be in total sensory deprivation for a second or so, and then have his evolution reversed. So I think this raises some ethical questions, like would Charlie actually agree to partake in an experiment like this? And even if he would, would we actually get ethical approval to do an experiment like this? But I think these questions actually are going to arise much earlier in artificial intelligence research. It's not going to be peculiar to quantum mechanical problems. So hopefully we will have sorted out all of these problems in the lifetime or so that it's going to take to make this experiment a realization. Okay, so let's assume that we can do this experiment. What would it actually show? So I'm going to give here a stab at a theorem which doesn't then have this assumption of superpowers, okay, which only uses reasonably plausible assumptions about what is possible technologically. And so maybe I'll just start with those. So those would be the assumptions that we can actually do human-level artificial intelligence. That's not something that everybody believes, so that's an assumption. And that we can do universal quantum computing at this extremely large scale and actually have to be very fast to be plausible and a friend as well. Okay, so those are the technological assumptions. I'm also going to change here the to be more specific instead of just saying, oh, well, it involves a friend. Okay, let's be specific about exactly what's going to be involved. And so there are many ways to do this, of course. I've chosen a particular way of breaking this up because of the interesting implications in quantum foundations or quantum interpretations, which I'll get to in the next slide. So here are the assumptions that I want to consider here. So the first one is physicalism. That says that any thought supervenes upon a physical process in the brain or other information processing unit as appropriate, such as a quantum computer, for example. Okay, so that ties the idea. So if you remember all the way back to the paper in preparation, our working title was A Thoughtful Local Friendliness Theorem. So this is all going to be formulated in terms of thought. To be able to say something about space-time, etc., we have to have an assumption that ties thoughts to actual processes in the physical world. And so that's this assumption of physicalism. Okay, the absoluteness comes in again, but I'm going to try to put it in is in a weak as way as possible. And so that's this assumption of ego absolutism. And so this is literally, when I'm reading this, I'm applying this assumption to myself. So I'm going to read it out now. And this is what ego absolutism means for me. Such of my thoughts that I believe I could, if asked, communicate to another party are absolutely real. In other words, like, I don't need a community of friends to make my thoughts real. If I can communicate a thought, it's real before I communicated it. Okay, it's real in an absolute sense. I don't need to say anything more about that. Okay, now friendliness. Okay, now we have this explicit assumption of friendliness, which is good for a local friendliness theorem. This is the way I like to put it. If by open-ended communication, an independent party displays cognitive ability on par with my own, then ego absoluteness is as true for them, mutatis mutandis, as it is for me. In other words, obviously, when they read it out also saying I, me, whatever. Okay, they don't refer back to Howard and say that ego absolutism is about Howard. No, it means that if there's another party that seems to be basically at the same cognitive level as my own, then I'm going to say that that if I believe ego absolutism for myself, then I'm going to allow them to have ego absolutism for themselves as well, and that's true for them. Okay, here, human level artificial intelligence and universal quantum computing, I already talked about. And then finally, local action is exactly the same as it's always been. Any free choice, but just to emphasize that the only free choices we need in this experiment are the one that Alice and Bob do. Okay, so they're definitely human level free choices, is correlated only with events in its future life. So those assumptions we can put together and derive a local friendliness theorem, a local friendliness inequalities. Sorry, the ones in black gives local friendliness inequalities. Then with these ones, I can say that it should be possible to violate those inequalities in the lab. And so that's interesting. We have a contradiction then between these assumptions and none of these assumptions are a sure thing. Okay, all of them can be questioned, right? But what we know then from the theorem is that at least one of them must be wrong. And so what I like about splitting things up this way is that it gives us a very fine grained look at how different interpretations of quantum mechanics go with those assumptions. Which ones do they say are wrong? And so for each of those assumptions, there's a fairly well-known quantum interpretation which picks out that assumption and says that one is definitely wrong. Okay. Yes, Lee. You're muted, Lee.
Lee, you should unmute yourself. We cannot hear you.
You have to unmute.
Yeah. Here we go. In physicalism, does that physical process have to be deterministic or unitary?
No. There's no assumptions like that.
So I could have a physical process that every once in a while gave you an unexpected answer.
Yes. As long as it didn't happen often enough to make universal quantum computing impossible, for example. So that's right. There are no assumptions, as there are in some of these Wigner-Friend theorems, that everything happens perfectly or whatever. No, that's not required. Okay. Okay, so I don't think I have time to go through all of these interpretations. So these are interpretations or modifications, I should say. So the first three of these are basically all collapse types of models. So they're actually, as I said, modifications of quantum mechanics. But interestingly, they have different, I think the way I read it is that they would single out different of these assumptions as being the ones that are wrong. So I think we don't know exactly what Wigner would have thought, for example, but one way of reading his paper would be to say that, well, if the universal quantum computer is actually running a being with the same types of sensations and whatever as I, well, then it can't be in a superposition. That's what he says. But that has the interesting implication that universal quantum computing is not possible. Okay. Penrose, I think, believes that human-level artificial intelligence is not possible for fundamental physical reasons. And that's why he would take that to be the wrong assumption. Then there are these more conventional collapse models like GRW, that will take, I'm going to say that the answer to what they actually reject is friendliness, but to explain that, I will maybe, that would take too long. So if people want to ask, they can ask. So this is a little weird, but bunched together are interpretations that one doesn't necessarily think of as being related, cubism and Everett's interpretation. But what they have in common is that they reject ego absolutism. I think they say that it's just not the case that even for me, when I'm talking about myself, I don't believe that my thoughts are absolutely real. I think that when I make a statement about that, it's actually about my thoughts that's relative in some sense. Okay, but we can talk about that more. There are some curious interpretations to reject physicalism. And of course, there's a whole lot of interpretations that reject local action. And so, for example, Bohmian mechanics does. But I think the most important point is that there are a whole lot of physicists, I think, who still think that quantum mechanics needs no interpretation, who think that if you individually ask them all of these questions, do you believe this? They'll say, yes, I believe. Yes, I believe local action. Yes, I believe physicalism. Yes, I believe that my thoughts are absolutely real. Yes, I'm a friendly person. I have no problem with that. Yes, I believe in universal quantum computing. I've got shares in a quantum computing company. And human-level artificial intelligence, sure, the experts all tell me that's just around the corner. And so they can't be... They are just wrong. Okay, quantum mechanics does need an interpretation. You can't just go and say, "Oh, the world is straightforward and there's no problems at all." No, that's just something's got to give. And this is why I think, what I like most about this interpretation, this way of splitting it up, is that it really gets to the heart of the sort of naive assumptions that most physicists, most people, if they ever thought about it, believe about the world, and they just can't all be true. Yes, question from Ikshul.
Yeah, sir. I had a question regarding your superpowers assumption and it not being a strong metaphysical assumption.
So this theorem, as I'm currently presenting it, does not have the superpowers assumption. Okay, it has been replaced by these assumptions. Well, essentially by this assumption of universal quantum computing.
Okay. No, but in general, the one that you proposed where you require the friend to be a sentient being similar in some form to the super observer,
So I guess that's, again, so the technical assumptions that are playing that role here are that human level artificial intelligence is possible and that universal quantum computing at arbitrary large scale is possible.
But I still had a doubt whether why it shouldn't be considered a strong metaphysical assumption, because I feel that it is natural to assume that such a friend, a quote-unquote friend, would be an open quantum system and thus not a priori disentangled from the superobserver. And thus, if this superobserver assumption does allow for one system to measure another, which
okay. is... So this is specifically why I wanted to formulate the theorem without using a superpowers assumption or anything. Okay. So the point is, I mean, I think what you have to do is look at this list. And I mean, yeah, what you're saying is, I mean, I'm quite happy for you to have, I don't mean to be condescending. The point of view you're putting across is perfectly reasonable, but what you have to articulate is which of these assumptions are you rejecting? Which of these assumptions do you think is wrong?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, no, you're welcome. Okay, so take home messages. So the general idea of experimental metaphysics is that metaphysical assumptions, which individually are non-testable, which is I think why the field has had a bad rap. Nevertheless, in conjunction, they can have falsifiable empirical consequences. And in the case of Bell, we can go further and say that these are falsified empirical consequences. So what I'm excited about is the idea that we have a new frontier in experimental metaphysics, a distant frontier perhaps, but it's coming from continued advances in artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and quantum communications, in fact, as well, which I didn't talk about in detail, but I could say something about that. So specifically, what I believe is that we could rule out through these advances the conjunction of these metaphysical assumptions of physicalism, ego absolutism, friendliness, and local action. Okay. And those are the short versions. And as I said, we performed a proof of concept experiment on the microscopic scale to illustrate the type of experimental results which would rule out this conjunction. Okay, and that's it. Thank you for your attention and patience.
Thank you very much for this very interesting talk. And we have time for questions, so you can either raise your hand. Okay, Rob.
Hi, Herod.
Hi, Rob.
I have a question about your characterization of Bell's theorem.
Mm-hmm.
Can you go back to the slide that was on?
So this one?
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is it. And so what I understood was you are going to replace predetermination with superpowers in the next no-go theorem.
In a sense,
That superpowers is no longer kind of a metaphysical assumption, but something
that's wrong.
Tested. And so in a sense, you're dispensing with a metaphysical assumption, namely this predetermination. And so that's a sense in which your no-go theorem is an improvement upon Bell's theorem. Is that a good characterization?
It is. But of course, yes. But it's a different class of experiment, and so we can't say. Yeah, I mean that's the basic idea. Yes, but I.
Okay.
Yep. No, let me just leave it at
that. Okay. So then, what I don't understand is, I don't think you need predetermination in this particular list. The way you define local action here seems to me to be sufficient to derive Bell inequalities.
Right. If that was true, then that'd be a gaping hole in my entire presentation. But I'm confident to say that it's not true.
Well, can you go to the next slide where you talk about the formal consequences of?
Yeah. There we go. Yeah.
So. I mean, why do I need to assume that these conditional probabilities on the first line are zero or one, as opposed to merely being in the interval zero, one?
Because
you're familiar with Fine's theorem.
Yeah. Okay. Because operational quantum mechanics satisfies all of these conditions, which I've written down in three. That's the short answer. operational quantum mechanics satisfies local action. Or quantum causal models, if you want to put it in those terms, satisfies local action. Because in quantum mechanics, the lambda simply don't exist.
Well, okay, so maybe this comes down then to a complaint about your characterization of local action. It seems to me that if I wrote down the expression for the probability of AB given XY, then the first thing I might do is say, all right, let me write it as probability of A given BXY, BXY lambda, and B given XY lambda. And then so the step one would be, you know, the conditional probability of A doesn't depend on B or Y.
No, but that's not at all entailed by local action. Local action says any free choice made in a manner appropriate to random variable, right, is not correlated only with events in its future lifetime. It doesn't allow you to say B is only correlated with events in its future lifetime.
Yeah. Okay. So I think maybe you misunderstood me, or maybe not. But if you go back to those equations, what I'm saying is that I believe your local action also implies that if I were to write down P of A given B lambda XY, that's equal to P of A given lambda X.
That does not follow from local action. No, you're just mistaken. Because local action, read it, just says any free choice is correlated only with events in its future lifetime. So how are you going to eliminate B from that equation? B is not a free choice.
I got it. I see. So it's because you changed from local causality.
Yes. So this is why I emphasize the local action is not local causality. It's more akin to locality. It's not quite the same as locality. You can roughly think of it as locality and superdeterminism, but I don't actually want to, I mean, and that's the way it's written in the Nature Physics paper, but we also comment in that paper that, you know, really it's much more elegant to just put those all together into this one simple assumption. But yeah, it's not the same as local causality. So it is definitely a weaker, it's a weaker, the assumptions we make are definitely weaker than the assumptions in Bell's theorem in that sense.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, and Tom, you had a question?
Yes, thanks for the talk. Yeah, my question is maybe a bit vague. It seemed to me that, so absoluteness seemed possibly, kind of intuitively, already slightly in contradiction with this idea that you can erase measurement results. Just because the idea that for me, you know, if a measurement result is kind of absolute, it should not be possible to kind of then like reverse time and, you know, remove the fact that the measurement happened. I was referring to the kind of the first experiment. Does that make sense? So as kind of
That makes sense, but I mean, I guess we are. So you're saying something can only be absolute if it persists forever in time once it's been. I guess I mean, we're not. So I guess that's just not what we mean by, but I mean, it's an interesting point to think about. Yeah. Is there something implicit that we are using that means that, I don't want to think of it that way, but yeah, this essential way is that we're thinking of a thought as an event in space time. Well, I should, with the assumption of physicalism, then a thought, there is a physical process which is associated with a thought. That physical process exists in space-time, and the existence there is absolute, whether or not that information in the future gets erased or not. I mean, I can see, so yes, if you don't think that way, I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know if that if that's any sort of loophole. I don't think it's any sort of loophole. I think that's just a different intuition. But it's an interesting point, yeah, that I should probably, yeah, that I'd be happy to think about more.
Yeah, maybe I can just, so it's not necessarily my, I mean, yeah, it's not necessarily my intuition, but it kind of comes from what I'd imagine would be a very standard or like old school orthodox Copenhagen. We say there's a measurement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then,
yeah.
The events are absolute and they're no longer things which are like dynamic or right. You've done your cut, your Heisenberg cut, you know,
yeah.
The detector's clicked and then nothing else can be said apart from the detector's clicked. So yeah. I was wondering, so that was to my mind, what I was kind of thinking by absolutely,
yeah. Intuitively. Okay, so I think that, so in that way of thinking about it, I think that traditional Copenhagen, et cetera, if it can be made into a, I mean, I think it's vague that different people would give different answers as to what Copenhagen says. But the way you're talking about it, I think it would say, well, then I'm just not prepared to apply this. I mean, I'm happy to apply this concept to me and to other people that are irreversible, but I'm just not happy to apply this to a quantum computer where that information can be reversed.
Yeah.
And so the way it's formulated here is, well, then that's just, you're not friendly. Okay, there are certain intelligent parties that you can interact with, but you know, when they're on their own, you're not prepared to give them the same status as you would to a human, and so that's actually, yeah, that in that way, I think it would fall in with sort of spontaneous collapse models.
Okay,
in say that, yeah, this would actually be false. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have more questions? Okay, maybe I have a question. So,
sure.
Okay, on this slide, are assumption 2 and 3 fully independent? Because it seems to me that friendliness, so do you have to believe in ego absolutism in order to believe in the friendliness assumption?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So the answer is no. So the assumptions obviously are not completely independent in the sense that this assumption of friendliness references ego absolutism. Okay, but the way it's supposed to be, the way it works is that no, that I could be friendly but also reject ego absolutism. So for example, in many worlds interpretation, I would say ego absolutism is wrong, because when I have a thought, that's not absolutely real. It's just real in one world, in this one world, in one branch that I happen to be experiencing. And so I would say, oh yeah, I'm a friendly person. I will give the same, the crucial thing is this thing, ego absolutism is as true for them as it is for me. Okay. So I could say, yes, it's as true for them as it is for me, which is to say not true at all. Okay. They have real experiences, but they're only real relative to the branch that they are in. And they may be branching independently from my branches. And yeah, and I can, but the difference with them is I can recohere their branches, but still when they are in a superposition, yes, they're having real thoughts, etc. It's just that they're real, but only relative to a branch or whatever, something like that.
Yeah, thanks a lot. That clarifies.
Yeah, yeah.
And Ile.
Hello, thanks for the talk. I really like the idea that you said we can test whether a conjunction of several metaphysical theorems is true or not. And I'm thinking about the future in this direction. So do you think that if we have a bunch of theorems considering different combination of metaphysical assumptions, and then, for example, we have one regarding, when one tells us ABC cannot be true at the same time, and then we have CDE, and then a bunch of others. And if we can find that C is always in,
right.
Yeah, then we can just say maybe, okay, C is the one that is not true.
And yeah, I know where you're coming from, but it's always frustrating that we prove these theorems but they just say, oh, it could be one of any of these that is wrong, and we can't say which one. You know, it seems like, well, we're no closer to, yeah, are we any closer, is it actually getting us any closer to, you know, a better theory, or being mm-hmm. able to rule out any interpretations or something like that? Yeah, I guess that's a hope to have, I think the whole experimental metaphysics is, the field is obviously not dead, right? It's still going. And so the hope would be that we could maybe rule out some of these, but I suspect, yeah, I mean, at this stage, we're not, yeah, I think at this stage, we and can't rule out any of these interpretations, okay? But mm-hmm. by having more powerful theorems and more powerful technology, the hope obviously would be get other theorems, etc., and eventually start whittling down these lists of possible interpretations or modifications that can apply. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think we're obviously getting, well, yeah, it's we are probably getting closer with collapse models to, but there are a lot of subtleties in those experiments, that most of the experiments that people are doing are not, you know, these experimental metaphysics experiments. They are ones that make a lot of physical assumptions about how collapse must work, etc. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think there's potentially scope there for, yeah, trying to come up with experiments that really make them minimal in terms of assumptions, and that would let us rule out some of these. But yeah, mm-hmm. so I think that's interesting. But at this stage, I can't say exactly what direction that would be.
Cool, thanks.
Yep.
We have one more question from Marina.
Paul, it's another clarification question. Can you explain mm-hmm. again the difference between local action and local causality about the discussion you were having with Rob?
Yeah, okay. So my
question is the same one. So maybe I'll just say, can I think of local action as local causality for a subset of the variables, namely the freely chosen ones?
Gosh, that's a bit awkward because it's not about correlations between free choices and other free choices. So I can't just only concentrate on free choices. So the earlier version of this talk, I think I had local causality, the equations up to change. But maybe to just come back to this one. As a very rough approximation, you could say that local action is more akin to a no signaling constraint than a local causality No, it's not the same as local. It's a stronger assumption than no signaling. Okay, it's absolutely not the same as the no signaling assumption, but in the sense that the sense that it concentrates on free choices is to talk about what are the consequences of free choices we make in the world. And local action says that, well, if you think that consequences are manifesting correlations, that if I make an intervention in the world, the only things that are going to be correlated with that are things in its future life kind. Okay. So it's essentially not about explaining correlations. Okay, so local causality could be said, maybe this is a way to look at it. So yes, yeah, so Eric and I have a whole paper about, we're actually writing another paper about concepts like this. But you have to put in actually a lot more you can't simply get local causality from local action. You have to put in a lot more assumptions about what correlations, you know, that if you have correlations, and that implies that there is a cause, and that cause has to be like where that cause has to be, like that cause has to be in the past light cone of the common past light cone of the things that are correlated. And you have to assume what we call the decorrelating explanation, which is that if you have a cause, then conditioning on that cause will remove the correlation. Okay, so two of those things you could put together as Reichenbach's principle. But there's actually quite a lot more that you have to add to get local causality. Like, you still need something like local action or a higher level concept. Basically, I'd say, you don't want to try to think about, oh, can I derive local causality from local action? Because it doesn't really work like that. You have to go up to more basic concepts, like relativistic causality and things like that, which you'd have to define in a suitable way in order to get back down to both local causality and local action, if you like. Does that, I don't know if that's answering the question at all. They are really quite different assumptions, I guess is what I'm saying. So local action, so if we have a concept of relativistic causality, that causes are only in the past light cone of their effects, or to put another way, effects are only in the future light cone of their causes. Okay. Then we have to add in quite a lot more statements. So then to get local action, all that we have to assume is essentially that free choices are uncaused. For an operational sense, at least, that that's the simplest way to say it, that free choices for the purpose of experiments can be considered to be uncaused events. Right? And then you get local action from that. Right. But to get local causality from an assumption of relativistic causality, as you call it, which is the idea that causes are in the past light cone or effects are in the future light cone, you have to add in quite a lot more about what does it mean for something to be a cause. I'm misrepresenting things, because even for this you have to talk about correlations and causes. I've got some really nice slides that would show this, but it's not in this talk. I'd have to get up another talk. Am I giving a useful answer at all? I just want to say that they are like neither is a consequence of the other, in fact. They can both, like both local action and local causality can be derived from more basic causal principles, but with different inputs that have to go in. Maybe an answer to Rob. I mean, local causality is not even enough to get Bell's theorem, in fact, because as people point out, you also need some sort of assumption of no superdeterminism. So I could not, in fact, have just had absoluteness of observations and local causality to get Bell's theorem. Okay, I also would need to rule out superdeterminism. So local action is doing that job here of ruling out superdeterminism. But if I had used local causality, I would still need another assumption, which could be local action. It could be something weaker, but it would still nevertheless be necessary to have something else.
Howard, is local action the same thing as the free will?
Okay, if you define free will as, or free choice as something like choices are uncaused, okay, so if I have that assumption, if I have the assumption of relativistic causality, which is to say that effects are only in the future light cone and causes are only in the past light cone, so those two things, and what do I also need? I also need a statement that relates correlations to causes. Okay. So I think I also need something like Reichenbach's principle in effect. Okay. I mean, that's probably stronger than I need, but I still need something like that. So I'm using Reichenbach's principle because I'm sort of assuming that maybe people associated with the PI heard Rob talk about this sort of stuff, but I could be wrong. I mean, it could be. So tell me if that's just a useless word to be introducing here, or useless phrase. Do you know what I mean when I talk about Reichenbach's principle? Yeah, okay. So it's not, yeah, so it's related to free choice in a bare sense, okay? But you still have to put in other assumptions related to space, time, and causality, and what causality has to do with correlations in order to get a, in order to actually get local action.
That was helpful, thanks. But I'm glad to hear that there's a paper coming out. I think it's interesting to analyze all these connections.
Yeah. Hopefully. Yeah. We're working for a deadline on that, for a special issue on that. So that hopefully will actually be out. Yeah, reasonably soon. But so Eric has a talk on this topic where he concentrates much more on the causality side of things, whereas I wanted to concentrate on the sort of future experimental prospects type of things. But so sorry for not being as prepared, having everything exactly clear in my mind to answer that question, but it is definitely possible to break down local action into more fundamental concepts, and one could then similarly to, as we talked about for analyzing Bell's theorem, also talk about which of those you might want to reject. But the important thing, I'm sure I've misspoken, because so this is important that again, I apologize for not having it 100% just in my mind to answer the question, but you don't need Reichenbach's principle to derive local action. And that's an important point, right? Is that, because a common way of responding to these sorts of paradoxes is to say, I can keep everything except Reichenbach's principle. I just need to replace that by something. So we don't need that to get local action. You don't have the option of just saying, I use quantum causal models, I don't have anything to worry about. Because the essential point is just that quantum causal models satisfy local action. You're not actually rejecting anything. So like quantum causal models, you say, I reject local causality because I reject Reichenbach's principle. And then I don't have any problems with experiments. The point is that you are in quantum causal models, you're not rejecting local action. And I would say in quantum causal models, it's a way of thinking about the world, but I would not say it's actually an interpretation of quantum mechanics, because it doesn't tell you which of these assumptions has to be wrong. I mean, it's just a way of thinking about conventional quantum experiments, but it doesn't answer the question of what if we do this, and we violate a local friendliness inequality in these circumstances. Which of these assumptions are you saying is wrong? And I don't think it gives an answer to that.
Super interesting. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. You're welcome.
Okay. So I think does anybody have more questions?
Well, I can ask a question, but it'll take it in a slightly different direction. Maybe I should save it and just write. Let me just ask the question and see if it goes in an interesting direction for you. There's a version of Copenhagen where the split is between the future and the past. Heisenberg wrote about that in Dyson and a number of other people. So that you simply say that the quantum state description is a description or projection of the future, and that things become definite in the past. And once something is in the past, it can't be undone and is definite.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Can you rule out such a...
Yeah, I guess that makes sense as a with this idea that observations are irreversible acts of amplification or whatever. As I said, I think what that means is that, I mean, yes, I think I can make sense of it, and I think it agrees with the answer that I gave before, that in terms of these assumptions that Copenhagen would come down as rejecting the friendliness assumption by saying that if you have an agent who's instantiated on a quantum computer that can be reversed, then if it can be reversed, then it was never real in the first place.
Right.
So what? The thoughts are not real. Yeah, I'm just not willing to grant that quantum computer is having real thoughts because it can be reversed.
I think what you would say is that if I'm talking about a quantum computer in the future, it can be reversed. And once it passes into the past, it is from then on determinedly whatever it was when it passed.
Yeah, well, what is it that was in the past? I mean, so the quantum state of the computer was in a superposition, or say, so that, but that's not a definite.
Well, Heisenberg and Dyson would say that it's not in a superposition once it's in the past.
Well, once it's been measured, but I guess the whole point is that here we want to plausibly have an observational thought or whatever and then reverse it without measuring it from the outside. Right. And so I think that's the challenge. Yeah,
our observation has to come after that.
And our observation has to come after that. That's right. Yes.
Thanks.
Any more questions? If not, we should thank our speaker again. Thank you very much again.
Thank you, everybody.